Hey everybody, doing another movie retrospective. Yeah. This is a good one we're doing today.
This fucking was a trip. George C. Scott entering the world of porn.
Sold.
And he's religious George C. Scott entering the world of porn to save his missing daughter.
Yeah.
And John Milius
produced
this, okay. And there is some Milius fucking shit in it, you know, it's good. It's also just bizarre because it's like anti-smut, but showing you smut. Smutty 70 skanks everywhere, male and female in the underworld LA, doing porn and prostitution and BDSM and all the shit. And they're all portrayed as like fucking basically subhumans.
Well,
everybody in the sex industry.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but because there are some likable characters in it. But I think the movie, to an extent, is actually kind of drawing. I mean, the reason it's called hardcore is because it's making a parallel between the porn industry and also the hardcore religious beliefs that George C. Scott and his people have.
I guess so.
So, and it's kind of pointing out his hypocrisy as well.
Yeah.
So this was written and directed by Paul Schrader, and I feel like it's one of the movies that people don't talk about. He said that it was one of his most personal films. It's actually kind of about his dad. He was raised in a very, very, very fundamentalist, like, religious background. And George C. Scott was based off of his dad. But Paul Schrader wrote Martin Scorsese movies, Taxi Driver, probably most famously, Raging Bull. He also wrote Last Temptation of Christ, Bringing Out the Dead. He directed the Cat People remake, which was actually really good.
Pretty good, yeah.
American Gigolo and Autofocus, which is, we should probably do that one too, because that's about Bob Crane, and that's from 2002. That's a great movie. So he directed that one as well. But I feel like this is one that doesn't really get talked about a lot. And I think that I saw this, I mean, it came out in 1979. Obviously, I was too young to see it, like, in the theaters and stuff, because I was only 7. But I think I caught it, or parts of it, on cable, like, maybe in the 80s. And then I just kept remembering it because of, like, Mystery Science Theater, they would always do the memes, like, turn it off, turn it off! Like, they would always do that, which is from this movie. So it just stuck in the back of my mind, and then when I was perusing through Tubi the other day, I was like, ooh, they just added it. And I was like, I've been wanting to rewatch that because I think I saw it a long time ago, and I'm really glad we did because this was, like, way better than I remembered.
Yeah.
Way better than I remember.
It was good. It was good. It was entertaining. I liked it. It was funny. It did have a lot of... Well, it's not really funny. It's just... There's some funny shit in it. I don't know. Just gotta watch it, I guess. George C. Scott, who... Playing himself.
like he always plays.
Yeah.
He's so shouty.
See, he was like that. Just
I love
stoic,
George C. Scott.
Kind of stoic. People.
He's perfect for this, though.
People were evidently afraid of him, you know, be on set with him. He was just a... George C. Scott didn't like Hollywood. He turned down Oscars and shit. He turned down an Oscar for Patton. And it wasn't because he thought Patton was a fascist. He thought the damn... He thought the awards ceremony was a joke. It was just a meat parade. He wanted nothing to do with it. But he would take... He took... On Patton, he took awards from other...
It was like the New York Film Critics Guild or something like that.
Yeah, he'd accepted that one, but he did not like the Academy. He wanted nothing to do with them. He thought they were phonies. He was also kind of embarrassed about being in movies and liking being in movies. He was embarrassed. He was more into doing live performances on stage. He liked that.
I kind of feel like a lot of really good actors have that.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of creative people in general, not just actors, you know, writers, artists, whatever... you have some, a lot of them have a large portion of like self-loathing.
Yeah.
And it's almost like if you're successful, you kind of feel guilty about it, like you're faking it or you shouldn't be successful.
Yeah,
or you're successful at the expense of someone else.
He was described as kind of a stoic and brooding self-loathing movie actor. He didn't like it, but he liked it.
He liked it, but he didn't like that he liked it.
He's embarrassed that he enjoyed the attention, but he really didn't want to be known for it.
I get it.
He wanted
it.
to He wanted to play King Lear and shit, you know, on stage.
I get it. Like I said, I think like a lot of really good actors, George C. Scott among them, do have that feeling, whether they articulate it or not, which he actually did.
Yeah.
But another movie this resembles, actually, if you've seen the 1999 Nicolas Cage movie, 8mm, this is essentially,
kinda like that, yeah.
It's pretty much like that. I think 8mm is more about a snuff film, whereas this one is more about porn.
Yeah.
But this does have a snuff film as a plot point as well.
Although it may have been a fake snuff flick. There's
well, that's
proof.
Kind of like, I mean, I guess in the context of the movie, like after I thought about it and after I read some other analyses of it, I'm guessing that it's implied that it's the real thing, but they don't really tell you like whether it's fake or whether it's real or not.
Because,
and like in the end, it doesn't really matter because I don't think that's like the main message of the movie anyway.
Because what they're showing in the 70s, 80s fucking sex industry is that they were all scammers anyway. They're fucking scammers.
Yeah.
So I suspect it was a fake, but they were, because they were spent. You had to pay $100 to see it, to just screen it, and then three dudes at a time. And I think it was a fake, but there was no way of knowing. The guy who made it, who was in it, overreacted and got shot in the back by the detective, which in real life, they'd arrested the detective for shooting that dude who ran away from him in the back. You know, just because you were a private detective didn't mean that you were, you know, out there fucking catching bad guys. It's a good movie. I'm just kind of critiquing it from, like, some of it was unrealistic.
Well,
it's just an action movie.
And I think that
an adventure movie.
I think it originally had a different ending too. I think that ending was a reshoot, which I kind of want to get into. So I am going to spoil it if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
It's on Tubi at the moment. So you can go watch it for free. But like I said, I'd seen pieces of it before, but I was actually surprised at how much I really liked this one.
Yeah, there was one girl in there he meets and kind of he hires her to help him find his daughter. She's a porn star / peep show girl / hooker type deal, you know, and she's nice and everything. She knows her life's fucked up, you know, and she in the end was like, oh, you're not gonna help me once you find your daughter, you're gonna split, you know, that kind of deal. He did, you know what I mean, which is kind of fucked up. The detective's like, nah, should I give her any money? He's like, nah. You know, you don't know this world. Just let it go.
Well, I mean, that was kind of, like I said, that was kind of like pointing out his hypocrisy of his character and, like, the belief system that he held to.
Yeah.
Which, like I said, when the rubber hit the road, did he really actually believe? You know, it's very, very easy to espouse certain beliefs, religious beliefs. But then when, like, some bad shit happens to you, then all of a sudden, all bets are off. And I kind of feel like it didn't hammer that home too much, but I think there was a lot of that going on in there.
Yeah, because, like, it was obvious that the girl was kind of ready to get out of that life, and he didn't fucking get her out of there, you know, like a fucking chump. And he didn't have a wife. He could say, you're coming with us. You can fucking rent a room upstairs. I'll get you back on your feet. You know, thanks for helping me.
That's what I mean. There was no reason for him not to.
Yeah,
but
because you're coming back to Michigan with me.
But you knew that was going to happen. Yeah, that's the thing, and I think that was pointing out.
Stay here.
Yeah, it's like I don't necessarily think the movie wants you to like think he's a villain. He's not a villain.
No.
But he's a complicated character. You know what I mean? It's like a character study of him, and by extension, like maybe his relationship with his daughter. Although interestingly, you don't see his daughter for pretty much the whole movie. She's only like at the very beginning and the very, very end. The rest of the time, she's just like a goal that he's working toward.
Yeah.
And it's mostly like about him and like his, you know, kind of going into the underbelly of like the LA porn scene of the late 1970s.
Yeah. I'm a Christian mythicist and cultural Christian. I don't believe any of that stuff is literal. I don't believe any of that shit really happened or anything. But I know the Christian culture real well, and the culture says that he should have taken her home with him.
And you'd think like any good person,
because she wanted to be rescued,
that had spent that amount of time with her,
yeah,
and that she helped him like
helped
find
him.
The daughter.
Right.
He found the daughter,
right.
And it's like you'd think that he'd be like, yeah, and he had money.
He owned a business.
He had a place. He had a daughter like about her age.
Yep.
You know, I think the daughter. The woman playing the daughter.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm glad that she looked a little bit older, but I think like the implication was, and I was reading another review of this, where they implied that the daughter in the context of the movie is actually supposed to be 14.
Okay.
Although the actress playing her doesn't look 14, which thankfully, but I'm just saying that I think in the context of she was supposed to be 14, which is why it was such a big deal that it's like, you know, she's a minor. Like, it wasn't just like, oh, she's 17, so it's not that big a deal.
Right.
I think she was supposed to be 14. I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah, I think the sex worker that was helping her, what, I don't remember what her name was.
Nikki.
Nikki, yeah. I think Nikki was supposed to be about 21, 22.
Yeah, she was obviously like...
She was older.
An older woman in the terms of,
Yeah, but, you know, still.
She said she'd been hooking since she was 15, right?
Yeah.
Like that she ran away with
you, and she basically she said she wanted to be rescued. He didn't fucking save her.
Yeah. Which, like I said, that was like real shitty.
That was kind of the gist.
And he smacked her around too when he was trying to get information. Yeah. Like he threatened to punch her in the face. Like he smacked her and then he was going to punch her in the face.
Yeah, we had to use fear because she wouldn't talk. He was just trying to get
his daughter anyway. Because she was scared.
Yeah.
Because he was getting in like way deeper than he thought, you know what I mean?
Although, you know, just which I can see how they were trying to point out the hypocrisy, because that's kind of one of the big foundations of the early Christian church, like second century, was saving people from prostitution and slavery. That's how it evidently grew, according to historians. So very un-Christian not to take the hooker with you.
But see, in the context of it, maybe we should do like a little bit of a plot synopsis, like before we get too much into this, because this is one of the things that I kind of wanted to touch on. So basically what the plot of the movie is, George C. Scott, he lives in Grand Rapids, Michigan, a very tight-knit community, very, very religious. It's Dutch Reformed, right?
Yeah.
So they're Calvinists. Which if you didn't know, they believe absolutely in predestination. They're kind of one of those motherfuckers that think like God, like before time started, has already picked out like the elect people, and it's like nothing you do matters essentially because he's already picked his favorite ones, and it doesn't have anything to do with whether you're good or evil or not. It's just whatever God's whim is. So
God already knows, and then your good deeds really aren't much compared to the grandeur of God. They're like rags before him and all that.
Yeah,
and that humans aren't really capable of any goodness compared to God is what they're saying. But people are saved. You can't just do whatever you want.
What I meant was, since God already knows, like, obviously you don't know, but you know what I mean?
You have
but
to be your best. You just don't know if you're going to be
you just don't know, and if you don't, like, you just got to suck it up, buttercup, because that's just the way the cookie crumbles.
Right, I was explaining that to a Muslim friend of mine. Them, you know, in Islam, it's all inclusive. You know, everybody can go to heaven, and even non-Muslims can go to heaven, and you know, everybody's supposed to be in heaven.
Well, a lot of Christian denominations are like that, too.
No.
Well, some, I mean, you know.
Most of them believe that it's a limited, very small amount. Some say it's 44,000, that's it.
Well, that's a Jehovah's Witness thing, isn't it?
There's a lot of them like that. Depends on which denomination. But no, Christianity really was always kind of an exclusive thing. Christian commandos, we're the ones going to go to heaven. You know, those other Christians now, don't worry about them. They're not going to make it. There was a lot of that going on for centuries, a long time. You know, they wiped out the Cathars because of shit like that. Christian sects fought each other constantly.
Yeah, big time.
So, but it was very exclusive. The idea was is only a small amount will actually go.
Yeah. So that's basically
and it's because they're not trying to get to heaven, because there's a difference between Eden and heaven, because according to what a lot of them believed, and this is all forgotten because people don't go to church anymore and they don't fucking learn the differences between all these denominations. Some of those denominations actually believe Eden will be restored on earth, and people who are saved during the rapture will eventually just inhabit a new Eden and a kingdom of God that's on earth. And you get the Garden of Eden back. Only some very small people go to heaven, and they're like, human souls don't belong in heaven. That's the place where angels and gods live, and maybe Moses and a couple of patriarchs from the Old Testament are there, you know. But no, not regular civilians, not regular even Christians, you know. But so no, there's a big hierarchy of who's going where. Jehovah's Witness, Mormons is even more complicated. You can get promoted into being a god and make your own universe. Where you're such a good Christian or such a good Mormon that you become God in a parallel universe. How's that for a reward?
Yeah, but so, basically, yeah. So what we're talking about is that Dutch Reformed, the sect that George C. Scott and his community is a part of, essentially believe in predestination, right? Yeah. So you get, like, at the very beginning, it's Christmas, and they're kind of having a big family get-together, and they're even talking about, you know, sin and all this other stuff at this thing. Now, apparently his daughter, Kristen, who, like I said, looks older. She looks about 18 or 19, but I guess she's supposed to be younger. She's going on a Calvinist, like, bus trip, and they're going out to that sinful land of California, and he's kind of worried about it, but, you know, they're going to have, like, a bunch of chaperones. It's a bunch of other kids her age, blah, blah, blah. So they go, and at first, you think that George C. Scott, his character's name is Jake, by the way, you think that his wife is dead because that's what he tells everybody, but that's actually not the case, which you find out later on. You actually don't find that out until about halfway through the movie. So she goes off on the bus trip. Now he gets a phone call, and somebody on the bus trip said that, well, they took a trip to Knott's Berry Farm, and she was waiting in line for the roller coaster, and she disappeared. So nobody knows where she went to. They can't find her. So he has to go out to LA and figure out, like, where she went to. Now, initially he goes to the cops. The cops care, but they're just kind of like, look, we have, like, so many missing persons cases, and a lot of these girls are going to end up dead. Yours probably just ran away, so don't fucking, you know, get all upset about it. So he's like, okay, well, he goes and hires a private detective. Now, the private detective is played by Peter Boyle, who has been in a million things, but will always be the monster from Young Frankenstein to me.
Yeah.
But he's actually, like, a really good character. Yeah. So George C. Scott agrees to pay him $750 a week, right?
Yeah.
To look for his daughter. And, like, a long period of time passes, but they don't really tell you that in the movie. Like, sometimes somebody will say, oh, it's been several weeks or it's been months or whatever. I think it ends up being like 4 or 5 months, like the whole thing. It doesn't seem like that, but that's how long it is. So this guy, the private detective, he finds somehow, I guess, I don't know if he's a porn connoisseur or if he just suspected that maybe she ended up in porn and so he was, like, investigating that avenue. But he comes up with this.
He had instincts.
He had instincts.
He had instincts. And he's looking at this real religious dude who says, my daughter would never do this and that. And he's going,
and they're like, yeah,
your
right.
daughter's fucking hooking.
Yeah.
You know.
So he immediately went to the seedy underbelly one of those Midwestern religious families that, like, their daughters are like, fuck this shit, and, like, took off for LA and ended up in porn or on the streets. Yeah. And so he finds this 8mm film, which very clearly shows his daughter, Kristen, getting banged by two dudes.
Yeah, a straight one and a gay one.
Yeah, so it's just kind of like, that's where the scene, like, turn it off, because he, shows it to him.
Yeah.
And he watches it for an uncomfortably long time.
Yeah, you're like, why are you watching this
That's
shit?
Your daughter, dude. Yeah. Stop it. I mean, he does tell him to turn it off. Like, I guess he's shocked, and he can't believe, but I mean, I don't know. If I was someone's, I don't know, I'm not someone's dad, but if I was someone's dad and, like, your daughter was, like, in a porn, I'd be like, no thanks.
Exactly.
I'm not.
Okay, I know she's doing this shit.
Yeah, just turn it off. I don't want that image in my head forever because that's never going to, you're never going to be able to bleach
he
that
had
out.
He had to face reality.
I guess. So then after that, like, he has a falling out with the PI because it turns out that the PI, perhaps for research purposes, is investigating all these other porn shoots and also, sampling some of the porn stars and hookers that he comes across. And he's just like, well, you know what? It's research. Which, like I said,
He probably could have found her that way.
Like, it probably would have been quicker.
That's how you do it.
Because, I mean, yeah, you don't want to pay the dude to just, like, bang hookers on the side, but he could be getting some scuttlebutt that way.
Well, they won't talk to you until you spend money on them.
Right. And that's kind of, they established that like, later on.
He tries to go up and talk, they won't talk to you.
And they're just like, what? Well, you want a massage or you want this or that? You want wrestling? You know what I mean? And he's just like, no, I just want to know. And they're just like, bye. You know what I mean?
They won't talk to you.
So he eventually, like, learns that. But I think that works good because it just shows, like I said, he's this very, very conservative, like, Midwestern, kind of, like, he's not wealthy, but he's probably, like, upper middle class. He owns a business.
Yeah.
And so he has no idea, like, about this part of the world, like, this part, this kind of underbelly.
Yeah, and he's not married either. His wife left him.
And, yeah, and you find that out later on. And yeah, it's just kind of like, you know, so, and he has these, like, weird, like, you know, even for Christians, like, pretty extreme beliefs, I guess. And he's never experienced anything like this. So he's completely, completely out of his element, like, completely out of his depth. So he has no idea how to deal with this. So, like I said, he just gets mad and, like, moralistic about the PI, like I said, doing some shit on the side. But, like you said, that probably would have been the quickest way to find her, because...
Yeah, just do a bunch of business and get to know him and eventually fall in with him in the...
And then they would talk to you, because they would learn to trust you. If you just have this dude, like, that's all uptight and
everything... Yeah, where's my daughter? They'll get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, they're like, we don't want anything to do with you. So, so after they have the falling out, and then he goes through... In a scene where he actually kicks the dude out of his own apartment. He cut the... Because he's George C. fucking Scott, and he can do that.
This is my apartment. Get out of here.
And he's like, get out. And he's like, but this is my house? Yeah. And he leaves.
Yeah.
Peter Boyle leaves.
And so, he gets kicked out because he was hooking up with a girl.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling.
Which, like I said,
I don't give a shit if you're George C. Scott. If I'm on a couch with some fucking girl who's 22 years old, fucking waiting to get it on, you're not going to get me out of the damn house, man. This is my house.
Well, the thing is, and it should be noted, too, that it's like, yeah, he's paying him $750 a week, but that doesn't mean that he has to 24-7 be looking for your daughter. I mean, he's on the clock, he's off the clock.
Right, yeah,
and
he's got spending money.
He gets, like, lunch periods and things like that too.
But that was just, the money I'm sending you is going to this. And he's like, yeah, this is how I'm going to find her.
Yeah.
But
like I said, I think that was on purpose, because it's showing how out of his depth George C. Scott's character was, understandably, because this is not something he had any experience with previously. So so he goes through, like, all the PI's shit, and he's like, I'm gonna find her my own self. Like, I'm gonna fire this motherfucker.
So he has to do the same damn
thing. So he ends up having to go. So initially, it's not real successful, because he goes into, like I said, all these massage parlors and live sex shows. Yeah, gets kicked out of a whorehouse. Because he's basically just trying to, like, strong arm his way through it, and it's really not working. No one's giving him any information, and all this other shit. So finally, he's like, okay, well, if you can't beat him, join him. And he essentially starts going to, like, porn shoots. Like, he says he's an investor, right? And, like, goes to that one guy, and so he
falls in with the professional.
Gets on a porn shoot, and then he has the idea. In probably what is the funniest sequence of putting an ad in the paper. He's like, oh, like, hiring male, because he's looking for the other guy that was in the picture.
Looking for the guys that were in the picture.
That were in the picture with his daughter, like the film, because he can't track the film down. It was one of those kind of just 8mm real ones.
It was
the
made
title
by
changed.
Kids.
Yeah. Like, in a hotel room or some shit. So, and because it was underage, everybody was like, I never heard of that movie, you know what I mean? Because they can't legally sell it. So he puts it out of the paper, like, looking for male porn stars, and he also puts on a ridiculous porn stash and a wig and he's got, like, those crazy, like, polyester shirts. He's like, this is what a porn producer would look like.
It kind of works,
which is kind of accurate, I guess.
Actually, you skip the scene when he goes to the damn official porn studio where they were the bigger porn studio that they had going, and it was the dude and his fucking assistant, this other guy, and there was a fucking really good scene.
That was good. Those two guys were funny.
Those two guys were fucking funny as shit. And then later on, when he's recruiting for porn stars, one dude shows up who I recognize, this big old black guy, and he puts on a fucking great performance in this fucking
movie. He's only in there for like a minute,
but
he's awesome.
He makes a fucking movie.
He's awesome.
He goes, my name is Dick Black.
Big Dick Black.
Big Dick Black.
B-L-A-Q-U-E, which makes it a million times better.
So you want to hire him? It's just, you got to see it. He thinks he doesn't want to hire him because he's black. And he's like, no, I'll take you that.
But he doesn't want to hire him because he's not the dude.
He's not the dude,
like,
in the film.
Like the skinny white dude.
Yeah, is that the skinny white?
The skinny white surfer looking dude.
What do you mean I'm not what you're looking for? And he goes, I can.
It's because I'm black, isn't it?
I'm black. Goes, I can bust a nut 10 times in a row. I can do this. He's just, everything he can do. I can stay hard for
resume.
2 hours. Going on and on.
It's great.
I can't remember what he's been in a bunch of movies. When you see him, you'll recognize.
He has. He was so familiar.
Yeah,
and I wish I could.
He might have been in Rocky, actually. I think he might have been in. I think he was one of. One of the trainers that were training
Yeah, Curtis you might Creed. Have something there. I should have looked that up. I forgot.
Yeah.
Because he's only in there for like a minute.
Yeah, but you've seen
but it's
in
a great
of shit.
Scene. Yeah, yeah, he's super familiar.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, just the funny thing, like he has all these people coming into his, he just yeah. rented a hotel room
yeah.
and he's disguised as a porn producer and all yeah. these people come in. And then there's like, you know, another kind of surfery looking dude who's like does gay porn. And then
yeah.
he comes in and he's like, don't you want to see my dick or whatever?
Yeah.
And he's just like, yeah, whatever,
yeah, okay,
fine.
Okay,
yeah,
fine.
Cool, great. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like after a while, he's just so over it. But then like the guy that was in the movie with his daughter, like shows up.
Yeah.
Named what was his called? Jism Jim.
Yeah,
Jism Jim.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
his porn name. I'm like, that's you might want to workshop that a little bit. That's not a great porn name.
Yeah, and he's gay. He's
yeah.
gay.
Well, not that. No, that was a different guy. That was a different guy. It was two. That was two different guys.
Oh, two different guys.
They were both. They both looked similar because they were okay. both like blonde, like thin surfer types.
Okay.
But no, the gay guy was the different guy than the guy that was actually in the movie.
Okay.
That was a different dude. But
no,
yeah,
no, they were both gay.
Well, I don't
they
know.
They were both gay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying.
Yeah, but, you know, I thought it was a woman at first, remember? In the movie?
Yeah.
In the movie. But then he shows up. No, because it was real grainy.
Yeah.
He's wearing woman's underwear.
Yeah. Or, well, I couldn't really tell because, like I said, it was grainy. And then I was like, well, in the 70s, like, some of the men's underwear also kinda looked like, kind of like women's
maybe,
underwear, so
yeah.
I couldn't really tell. They were kind of like, you know, ball hugger
types. I was under the impression that he was supposed to be gay. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really get that, but, you know, maybe. That is, I don't know. But, like I said, it wasn't as specific as it was, like, with the other guy.
Yeah,
who
yeah
was,
the other guy was
like, you know, he had done this, that.
He was trying to have sex with him.
Yeah.
For the job.
But, and yeah, he was like, yeah, can I show you my dick? And he's like, yeah, sure, whatever. Yeah, yeah, it's great. So, you know what I mean? Which is, like, super funny. But then, like, this guy, he's like, he says something that's very interesting to George C. Scott. He's like, because he shows the picture, he's like, I'm looking for this girl. Like, I think her name is Kristen, or maybe she goes by Joanne, which was actually her mom's name, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
But, you know, and he's like, oh, I'm never working with that bitch again. Like, she did some freaky ass shit, or she's into some freaky ass shit, or something like that.
She chewed my dick up or something.
Yeah,
like, that.
Like I was raw for however long after, and all this other stuff. And George C. Scott is not having it, and beats the shit out of this guy. Like, he doesn't kill him, but he beats the shit out of the guy, and he's like, look, I don't know where the fuck she went to. I only worked with her that one time. I don't even remember what that fucking movie was called. I only got $25 for it.
Yeah.
And but he sets up with this other lead. He's the one that sets him up with Nikki, right? It's like, yeah, I think she knows, like, she knows her, so
she knows
so
who go. She is.
So yeah, so then he ends up going to this other, like, kind of peep show sort of place and meets Nikki. And then Nikki is easily the most likable character in this movie. So they kind of like establish a friendship, and he's like, look, I'm not paying the PI anymore. I will pay your expenses, same thing, like $750 a week or $900 a week or whatever, for you to come with me. Cause they get like, leads that now Kristen's in Mexico or she's in San Diego or whatever. And so they're kind of like following all these leads around. So I think like the heart of the movie is the discussions that him and Nikki have about, she says she's a Venusian, like, you
from
know what
the planet
I
mean? Or something.
From the planet. No, well, like, goddess of love.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. But, yeah, she says she ran away, but she's actually, like, a really likable character, and she tells him, when he goes into all this detail about his Calvinist beliefs, I mean, she basically says to him, she's like, phew, I thought I was fucked up, and I'm like, right? Yeah. So, so there was that whole thing. But the thing about it is that, so after a while, she really helps him out, and... You know, she gets to a point where, you know, obviously she probably didn't have a father figure or had, like, a very negative one. So she's just kind of like, she doesn't come out and say that she wants to get rescued from all this bullshit that she's been dealing with her whole entire life. But she does put it out there.
Yeah.
And he kind of, like, promises her, you know, she's like, oh, but, you know, once you find your daughter, you know, you're just going to throw me away. You're going to forget all about me. And he's like, no, that wouldn't happen. And all this other kind of shit. I'll help you out.
Yeah.
But then, like, at the end, when he does actually end up finding his daughter, and she's fine, but she basically tells him what we've suspected all along, that she's like, I didn't get kidnapped, because he was like, no, they took you, and she's like, but fuck that.
Well,
she's like, I took off, I ran away, because you suck, and, you know what I mean? He didn't really want to deal with that.
Yeah.
And so he's going to take her back home, and it's supposedly a happy ending. Like, the guy that was doing the snuff film, because there's also, like, a little side plot about a snuff film.
Her boyfriend was doing the snuff
film. Her boyfriend was doing the snuff film. Yeah. And, you know, so, although, like I said, the snuff film looked fake, but to me, the weird thing about it is that they charge $100 to go see this snuff film, and then it's over in, like, 2 minutes. Like, they kill the people, like, right away. I'm like, don't you want to, like, make it last?
Yeah.
I would think, I mean, I'm not if it was a real snuff film. I'm just saying that you would think for that amount of money you'd want to get your money's worth.
Well, the one that they show you is obviously not real. It's made for the movie.
Well, yeah.
But it was so, to me, it seemed so kind of fake that I think they were trying to say that it was not a real snuff film.
Like, in the universe of the movie, it's not a real snuff movie.
Yeah, I think that it was for suckers, because there were scam artists.
That's what I'm saying. They never tell you definitively whether that was a real snuff movie or not, but I'm kind of suspecting, because it kind of goes along with the theme of the rest of the movie, that would make sense. Because honestly, making snuff films and doing
that
seems like more trouble than it's worth when it would be very, very easy to fake it.
Yeah, and he didn't ask to see a snuff film. He says, I want to see the real exciting stuff. Oh, you want to see the real exciting stuff.
Yeah, the exciting stuff.
Oh, exciting. Okay. And then,
the real fucked up shit.
That could be anything, you know what I mean? So I think what it was is just to meet market demand, because you see that these are sophisticated operations, you know, where they had the damn dungeons and shit like that.
Those were all real sex clubs and real. They shot them in all real places.
Yeah, they're like sets
in LA.
Shit. So they would just to meet market demand come up with any old bullshit. Oh, yeah, somebody charging $200 for that. You know what I mean?
Because, like I said, why would you go to the trouble and danger of making a real one?
Why would you kill somebody worth a lot of money?
Right.
Because you can
economically, it doesn't really make any sense.
And then if the cops get involved, you're going to fucking prison. And then you're not going to make a lot of money on this, probably. So it's a risk. Better just fake it.
Yeah.
And then you can prove, and you got hidden. If the cops ever show up, you've hidden the proof. Like, look, here, that girl's still alive.
Yeah, there she is.
There she is. You know. Like with Cannibal Ferox.
Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah, Cannibal Holocaust. A movie that they fucking...
And he brought in the actor. I didn't kill them, I promise. They are.
Right.
Jesus Christ.
Right.
But yeah. So I don't know, like, in the universe of the movie. But at the end, you know, he takes his daughter back, you know, because at first... She's just kind of like, I ran away, like, you never loved me, and he's like, well, nobody ever showed me how to show any emotion, because he's, like, real cold and controlling, which I'll get into in a little bit, too, but he's just starts crying and stuff, and then he's like, well, do you want me to leave? And then she kind of changes her mind, and she's like, no. So he takes her back home, but then Nikki is out there, and she kind of, like, looks at him, and he's just kind of like, and then says to the PI, it's like, well, can I give her some money or something? And they're just like, nah, just fuck
off. Yeah, just let her go.
You don't belong here, he says.
Yeah, go back home.
So everything that Nikki feared about him turned out to be right.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, what I've heard, I don't know if it's entirely true or not, but the original ending of this, which I'm not sure, because I felt like the ending of this was a little bit abrupt, but the other ending, but this wasn't actually the ending that that Paul Schrader wanted initially. The original ending was just going to be, he goes through the investigation, and then he finds out, I think, that his daughter was actually killed in a car accident that didn't have anything, she had gotten into porn, but it didn't have anything to do with the porn industry, and that would have been, like, more, again, like, challenging his beliefs in, like, predestination, because, like, well, that was meant to happen, can you deal with that? Because I do kind of feel like there is sort of an undercurrent of him thinking that everyone's fate is already sealed, like, what's going to happen to you, there's, like, nothing that you can do to change it. But then when his daughter gets kidnapped, it seems like he doesn't really have the strength of his convictions, because he's like, well, I have to go look for her, and I have to do this and that and the other. So it's almost like he's trying to change the outcome, even though he supposedly believes that you can't change that, like, you can't change people's fate. You know what I'm saying?
I guess so.
So there's that whole thing. Now, so I don't know. So I don't know if that would have been a satisfying ending. And the thing about this one, I feel like this was more, you know, the studio or whoever, they're like, well, we want, like, the happier ending where you find her and, like, take her back home. But then I'm just kind of like, well, is that ending all that much happier, though? Because Nikki got fucked over.
Yeah.
She was like the most likable character. Yeah. And Kristen, who you don't even know because you only see her for like a minute at the beginning of the movie and a minute at the end, she's kind of like a blank slate. She doesn't really even get to talk until the very end. So you don't really connect with her. She's just like a cipher or like a goal. So I kind of feel like...
And she wasn't that cool either.
Yeah, and she wasn't really that cool. So so I think that that's kind of highlighting what he was saying about predestination, because it's like Nikki... You know, even though she was a really cool, nice, likable person who helped him out, she's still damned. Like, she's damned to have a shitty life forever, even though she didn't really do anything to deserve it. Whereas Kristen has is going to have, like, a really good life. She's going to go back to the Midwest and
presumably
go back to being normal. And it's like, she doesn't really deserve that either. Yeah. But then the thing about it, too, is that even though they both go back home... nothing's ever going to be the same between them again. I mean, they've, and they had a shitty relationship before, obviously. And I feel like that maybe is not going to ever be resolved because now, you know, she's done porn and she's like seen, like gotten a little taste of freedom, I guess. And she's kind of told him what she thought of him. And he's also seen like the seedier side of life. And so
he
can't really go back to like the bubble he was living in. Yeah. So I don't know how much happier it is. And like I said, I don't think he ever grew or changed as a person, because like, remember I mentioned before that like he would tell people that his wife was dead.
Yeah,
you find out later on, and actually Nikki was real perceptive. She's like, your wife's not dead, is she? And then he's like, wow, how'd she figure that out? No, she left him, but he tells everybody she's dead because it's easier, I guess. And
it's more honorable.
And I guess they don't, I mean, they don't, this is by implication, just there's a couple of scenes in there. You're meant to think that she left and the daughter ran away because he was so controlling and, like, strict. Like I said, not only at one point later on does he, like, beat the crap out of that guy who who's just, like, some low-level nobody, but he also hits Nikki and is going to punch her in the face, like, if she didn't tell him anything about it.
Yeah.
And there's a scene... And I wondered why this scene was in there, but then, like, when I thought about it, you know the scene where, because he owns a company, it's like a furniture company or something?
Yeah.
And there's a scene at the beginning, near the beginning, where he goes and he talks to that graphic designer who just made him, like, a new sign or a new thing for his out. And he's talking about how he likes it at first. And he's like, oh, well, I wouldn't have hired you if I didn't want your input or, like, for you to do it. But then, like, after this conversation and back and forth that they have... they end up doing what he wanted anyway, not what she wanted.
Yeah.
So you can see that he's very, very used to, like, getting his way. If he can't, like, strong-arm his way by, like, literally punching somebody, then he'll just manipulate you into doing what he wants. So, like I said, he's a very, very controlling person in that way. And you're led to assume that that's why his wife left him. They don't never say that, but that's what the implication is, and that's why his daughter ran away. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of feel like there's a lot in this movie that's going on beneath the surface, I suppose. But yeah, this is a really, really good one, and I feel like when people bring up, like, Paul Schrader's other stuff, this one doesn't get talked about as much, which is kind of a shame. Like I said, I do think the ending was a little bit abrupt and a little bit, like, too easy of a resolution. At least I thought that when I was watching it, but the more I thought about it, the more I thought, no, that was probably, like, the right ending to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's that whole thing, but... What else? Do you have anything else you would like to say about it?
No, I really didn't read into it that much. It was just a movie. It was entertaining. And yeah, he was a fucked up dude. And I wouldn't have done it the way he did it. He made a lot of
money. I wouldn't have either. Like I said, you can... But
he had no street smarts at all.
Well, but that was... Yeah. That's in line with his character, though.
Yeah.
I mean, he lived his entire life in the Midwest. He was super, super religious. He lived among other religious people.
Yeah.
And he didn't really have any experience outside of that bubble.
Yeah.
So, like, when he was confronted with seedy-ass L.A. in 1979...
Yeah, which was seedy as shit.
Yeah, it was.
Seedy as shit. I left L.A. in fucking 81 and fucking lived in fucking Carson, California. It was outside. It's a suburb outside L.A., also in Long Beach. And I remember, you know, it was just... Carson was just a lower middle class or working class neighborhood. It's normal, you know, suburbs. And you would see those coin-operated fucking newspaper machines they used to have back then. And they'd have, it'd be porn in them.
Yeah.
And these are just, you know, next to the damn local dime stores and grocery stores, you know, just, it's not the way people imagined. It was not uptight at all. Like, you know, not California during that time, during the 70s. Wow.
Well, I kind of feel like because porn had only recently been sort of mainstreamed, normalized.
I think it was became legal.
Yeah, it became legal, so I kind of feel like everybody was just like, woo, like the doors just busted open. Yeah. Like, now you wouldn't have that because you don't really need to. Like, everybody's surrounded by porn 24-7.
The 60s and happened, and then 70s hippie kind of stuff happened, and you used to go, we used to go to, like I told before, you know, you go up to Sequoia or Redwood National Forest, go to Lake Clarko, which Lake Clarko's, I don't know what that's like now, but when I was a little kid, go, you know, I had my aunt take me down there and everything. It was fucking nudism half the time. Just teenage girls and little kids and grown women walking around, fucking the men just running around nude, fucking swimming, which I guess is kind of innocent when you look at it, you know, in a certain way, you know, just... world was a little safer place, I think, back in, at least up in the mountains it was, but they were just smoking weed and just weird. It was another world.
It wasn't that safe. There was like all kind of serial killers running around.
They didn't know. You just heard about things on the radio, you know, certain things happening, but it was just, it was always like, well, that never happened to me. You know,
thing about it is that shit's safer nowadays, but the problem is that you hear about more shit now because of, like, you know, 24/7 we have information at our fingertips all the time, whereas back then you were low information, so it was much easier to believe that shit was safer even though it actually wasn't because you didn't hear about it as much.
Yeah.
That's, I think, the only difference.
But up in the forest, you know, like in Sequoia, it was all campers. It was almost like a community. And it was the families and friends and park rangers. Park rangers would come up with a dam, come up to your campsite, you know, because my aunts were cute, you know, young and cute, because Paula would come and shit, you know, and it would attract all the damn park rangers, and they'd show up with fucking guitar and fucking start in the campfire and fucking singing Rocky Mountain High, and they'd fucking give out fucking weed. Yeah. They had guns and shit, they were fucking smoking weed, and some of the park rangers were females and shit. They had a good time back in those days.
But yeah, I mean, if you definitely want to see, if you want to see kind of like a snapshot of what the seedy part of LA looked like in 1979, this is actually a good one because, like I said, they shot on location. They shot in real sex shops and real massage parlors and all, and real live sex shows, all of that stuff. You know, you can, it's just a sticky, sticky movie. Yeah,
I can remember seeing stuff like that, but I was only seeing it from the fucking, you know, passenger side of a car, you know, mom taking me somewhere, you know, driving through it. Remember going downtown Long Beach, you know, and seeing like the Pussycat Theater, which is all porn theaters and shit, you know. But I don't think that's where all the real hooker stuff was happening. I think that was more like L.A., Los Angeles, fucking downtown areas, I think.
Yeah, because that's where this was shot.
Right, but, you know, it was also kind of spread out in downtown areas of other little cities, like, you know, Long Beach. Had some of it, you know. I think that might have anywhere where there was damn military bases and stuff, because that was military and naval ship and shipyards. That shit was around there, strip clubs and stuff. Remember, you used to see them, cheesy lights and fucking bad fucking graphic design on things, and to see it, I forgot how cheap things looked. Things looked really cheap.
Yeah, well, shit was cheap.
The signs and the lighting and everything, you know, and just didn't have the technology.
Yeah, we had crappy shit back then.
Crappy. Yeah, it was real crappy.
Everything was real crappy.
And they showed the interiors, you know, L.A. interiors inside of fucking apartments. And I remember, you know, we had friends that lived in places like that, how crappy the chairs and the shit looked and the fucking carpeting and the, it's kind of a time capsule.
One thing,
70s looked pretty crappy.
One thing before we go, I kind of wanted to address this a little bit, because I read a review of this from The Time, from 1979.
Yeah.
And the reason the reviewer didn't really love it was because they thought it would have been better, or the character, George C. Scott's character, would have been more interesting if he was actually tempted by the world of porn. I'm not sure I agree with that, though. I think it worked better.
I kind of thought that was happening, though.
Well,
remember how his friend came and tried to save him? He says, go back home. Don't tell him you found me, type of deal. I thought he was maybe fucking around with it a little bit.
I don't know if it was so much, it wasn't real clear whether he was actually kind of getting involved with it or, I don't think it was. I think it was more like he had just become obsessed with finding his daughter because of his controlling nature. Like, I have to find her and I have to get her back.
Yeah,
more than get actually like being like, oh, hey, maybe this is a new career path that I could go on. You know what I mean? I do kind of feel like maybe...
He was showing up to shoot.
That's true.
Yeah,
but see, it's hard to say because he was just trying to get information. He was just like trying to find her, and he realized, like, finally, which what the PI had been trying to do the whole time was that he would need to like immerse himself in that world to actually get any information from anybody, because otherwise nobody was going to talk to him. So
I thought the PI was more more interesting. He was like, you know, he knew all the hookers and all the porn stars and stuff, and he was like, you know. Like, he told Nikki, he's like, what are you going to do? You got to stay here. What are you going to do? You're going to go and you're going to get a job?
Yeah.
You know? You're going to go work at, what do you say? You're going to work as a receptionist or something?
Yeah. Cosmetologist.
Cosmetologist, yeah.
Which, like I said, I mean, if she moved somewhere where nobody really knew her, she probably could if she went to school, but
she wouldn't be able to put up with it, she wouldn't be able to put up with
it. That's true.
She was used to freedom.
Yeah.
Running around and just like, trying to make a few dollars every day, having fun. You know, she seemed to have fun with it.
Well, the thing about it, there's actually, like, an interesting conversation that she has with George C. Scott's character where she says to him, they're talking about sex, and he's just kind of always like, oh, everything's on set, they sell everything with sex and blah, blah, blah. And she says to him, she says something interesting. She says, well, you know, you don't care about sex, or sex isn't that important to you because you don't, like, feel any lust, or it's not important to you. Where it's like, it's not important to me either, because I'll just fuck anybody and not really give a shit about it.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's almost like two sides of the same coin.
She's
which is like,
she didn't care.
She was indifferent about it. So it's like, they really were, like, their characters were really interesting with parallels. So I kind of feel like their interactions were kind of like one of the best parts of the movie, I thought.
Yeah.
And like I said, that's kind of where the heart of the movie was. But yeah, if you haven't seen this one, it's from 1979. It's on Tubi at the moment. I think there's also been like a really nice Blu-ray released of it quite recently, and I think it even has a Paul Schrader commentary on it. He doesn't love this movie. He thinks it's one of his weaker ones. Like I said, it's kind of one of his more personal movies because it's kind of about his dad. But they said that his commentary is just all like criticizing his own work, like, man, I could have done this better, I could have done that better, stuff like that. And I'm just like, okay. But I don't know. I kind of feel like this is a really, really good one. I don't know if it was as good as, you know, I don't think it's as good as, like, Taxi Driver or anything like that, but I really, really liked it.
A lot of skanks in it.
There's a lot of skanks. Everyone was so skinny back in the 70s.
Yeah.
All that cocaine, man.
Yeah, back in the 70s, you know, fucking a skinny slut was called a skank.
I think that terminology is still...
Probably still in effect.
I think everybody knows what you mean when you say that.
They walked around fucking in fucking halter tops and fucking
like
tube tops.
Tube tops, yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Bell-bottom pants and fucking long boots. Fucking Nikki did have one cool outfit. So it was a black, real tight black jeans, black sleeveless shirt, and those fucking tall, knee-high fucking boots, brown boots that folded over with like a... Yeah, that was pretty. That was a good.
She was pretty rad looking. Actually, that outfit you could wear that now
you
and
wear
get,
it today,
you
yeah.
get away with it. You want the sunglasses and everything.
Yeah.
Everybody would be like, "Wow, look what a fashionista you are."
But she was would be considered a skank. She was a skank.
Yeah, but she was a nice.
Yeah, she's cool. Yeah,
that's no judgment.
Right. Yeah. Skinny coke whore. Titties hanging out.
I mean, everybody was a skinny coke whore.
Yeah,
in this movie.
Actually, titties hanging out, more like nipples hanging out. Okay.
Yeah, like I said, 70s. Everybody's super skinny, so they were all pretty flat.
Flat.
All right.
Flat ass.
But yeah, if you've seen this or if it sounds interesting to you, let us know in the comments and we'll have a discussion about it. And that will do it for this movie retrospective. We will see you guys on the next one. Bye.